Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Our second item on the agenda is to review of a report from our actuaries and Mr. Hogan from Milliman and Mr. Herman from Milliman are here tonight to present the report to us. We are prepared to listen very attentively to every word you say.
Is there a test afterwards, Madam Chair?
Nope.
Nope. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. To the commission. Mr. Hogan, are you first?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the commission, it is our pleasure and privilege to be here to discuss the details of the report we just completed, our review of the actuarial reports by the various funds. We have prepared some information that you should have, and we'll be following kind of a slide handout format.
And that is this?
Correct, yes. I'm William Hogan, and to my left is Tim Herman, and we have prepared this based on the work that we did for the last 4 months reviewing the information that was submitted on the actuarial valuations for the state of Minnesota. I'm going to let Mr. Herman talk about the process we take briefly. I will then talk some about our overall results and observations from that review. And then Mr. Herman will review in a little more detail some of those results and observations that we have made. So with that, Tim, would you like to get started?
Mr. Herman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So page 2 of the handout kind of gives you a high-level overview of the funds that we reviewed. For the 5 different systems, select funds were reviewed. A couple different areas in which we reviewed are shown on page 2. We've done both a replication and a limited scope review. Go into a little more detail about what those are in a couple seconds. The main parts of doing the actual review are to address the key processes in an actual evaluation. So we're looking at membership data, financial data, the benefit provisions, and then actual assumptions and methods. The goal is to perform sufficient review to assure that the fund actuary's results are accurately reflecting all those different aspects of the valuation. On page 4, we get into a little bit of what the differences are. In a replication valuation, we are taking the member and financial data and loading that into our valuation system in an attempt to completely replicate the fund actuary's results. In a limited scope review, we take a little bit different approach. Rather than completely redoing the valuation, we ask for sample life information on a few select individuals. We don't do that on a random basis, but rather we artfully select certain people to look at so that we're testing different benefit provisions and assumptions that go into the valuation process. Some of the balancing items between limited scope versus a replication audit are budget, how much money do you want to spend on the review process, versus the level of precision that you look out of getting out of the results. So when we do a full replication audit, if we find a difference between the fund actuary, we can typically quantify what that is, but in a limited scope audit, we can't exactly quantify how much difference, or how much dollar difference that might have caused. We can give directional guidance, but not necessarily specific dollar amounts. This past 2013, we did replication audits on 4 different funds. In MSRS, it was the State Patrol and Correctional Fund. And for PERA, it was the Police and Fire Fund and Local Correctional Fund. On page 5, within doing an audit, there are no specific guidance or published guidance. There's not anything like an auditing firm would have as far as generally accepted auditing practices. It's really based on judgment and emerging practice within the field. Typically, what we're looking for is to, when we're doing a full replication, to come within a certain tolerance as far as the percentage basis is concerned. We're looking at funds that have very large numbers associated with them, so small percentage differences can lead to large dollar differences. For example, on TRA, with $23 billion of assets, if there's a half a percent difference, that's $115 million. So big dollar amount, but we as actuaries still look at that half a percent difference, and typically we're okay with results that are within those kind of tolerances. Within doing evaluation, we recognize the fact that each actuary typically uses their own valuation system, and the way those systems are coded can produce same different results for looking at the same problem. And also within the actuarial profession, we recognize that there are different ways of measuring things, and each may be reasonable in and of themselves, and that might be another source of the difference. But again, the goal is to reach a reasonable level of assurance that the results are portrayed accurately and reflect the true measure of what the fund is. So the next page is key findings. Bill, that's where you take over again.
Mr. Olgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. On slide six, we've listed a number of what we would call key findings. I think the very first bullet point on that slide is a significant finding, and that is that in general, we believe the valuations have been performed accurately. There are small, minor notes in our report for most of the valuations. That's not unusual. They're really not big items that would affect the integrity of the results that you received for the valuations. However, we did have some concern with one item, and that's our second bullet point, and that's the entry age normal funding method that's used in the valuation report for the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund is a little different than what the other funds have been using. And as we get into some of our observations, we have some concern with that method. We're not sure that it really fits the actuarial standards explicitly. And it's a bigger concern is related to just how that operates within the between separating normal cost and amortizing unfundeds, which we'll express a little more detailed later on. The consistency appears to be there from year to year, which is important so that you are able to see in the report results that the trends that are occurring and developing within the funds. And we believe that in general, most of the ratios and disclosures have been done appropriately. We also note that all of the changes that affect the funding calculations from the legislation last year have been addressed and adequately accounted for in the calculations. Okay, moving on to slide seven then. Yes.
Excuse me, right there. When you mentioned the thing that you weren't sure about in the Duluth Fund, when you find that, do you communicate with them?
Yes, we've had discussions with the fund actuary, and we have also noted that in more detail in our report as well.
Okay, thank you. Please go on.
Thank you. Slide seven. Slide seven. We've put out some observations that we've noted. Some we've noted in the past and felt that they needed to be addressed again. The first bullet relates to the operation of the post-retirement cost of living adjustments and the impact of the funded percentage relative to what level of COLA gets paid. The methodology that's being used is, in our opinion, you know, we agreed to what we have been using, and it's more of a stopgap measure, I guess, is what I would term, and a more definitive methodology should be addressed for a long-term solution there in the terms of valuing that. We also have some concerns about the level amortization and the supplemental contributions and how that interacts with the calculation on it as a percentage of payroll. And we're going to talk a little bit deeper into that in our report here about what the implications are there. And I think the bottom line is having a percentage of payroll method relative to what the experience is and what that does to the how that impacts the funding calculation. And that second bullet point kind of dovetails into our concern on the method in the Duluth fund. The entry age normal method is an accepted method in many instances in the history of public plan funding, but it tends to put more of the costs into the amortization of unfunded and less into the prospective normal cost calculation, which for Duluth kind of is aggravating their situation, in our opinion, based on the experience that we're seeing with respect to the ability to amortize that unfunded over future payrolls. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then another issue that we're encountering on the next bullet point is that will need to be addressed at some point is the use of sample life audits relative to replication audits. Sample life audits are valuable to look at the results of evaluation without expending the full effort of trying to replicate an evaluation, which does have the advantage of being less costly. Those are only effective, however, if you can get all the data that you need. And so many actuarial firms are looking at providing less data in the future in order to prepare an audit. We ran into a little bit of that this year, and so to do sample life audits in the future, we'll need to address how we're able to get that data to do that, or the sample life audit is probably not going to be a valid methodology without getting additional detail. And finally, we wanted to mention, and we'll talk a little bit about a new actuarial standard of practice that the American Academy is coming out with, as it relates to the selection of economic assumptions, specifically in general interest rate assumptions for the actuary. It's more for an informational item for the commission to understand what the actuary will be looking at as this standard of practice becomes applicable. So with that, I'd like to pass over back to Mr. Herman to get into some of the detail of these findings and observations.
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, thank you. So on page 8, we kind of give a high-level summary of some of the key findings from the review of the individual funds. It's the one point that I'd like to call your attention to on this page is, in most cases, the first bullet point there says no material findings. So overall, good results as far as the review of the funds that we've looked at. Did want to point out for the Duluth teachers, as Bill's already mentioned, there's a few different issues, and there's a number of issues that we've had. We've raised in our review of the Duluth Teachers Fund. That in and of itself, the number of issues that we've raised causes a little bit of concern there, too. Page 9, a few more general comments. First, Bill mentioned before that the 2013 legislation has been reflected. In general, saw some good improvements in the funded status of the funds. However, there are a few funds that still have some significant challenges. As of 2013, there's a small difference between the actual value and market value of assets. We are now in a position where, for most funds, the actual value of assets is less than the market value. That means that by using the smoothing mechanism, we have some gains that have occurred in the past few years that have not been fully reflected in the actual calculations. That's good news. So going forward, as future experience emerges, we expect funded ratios to beginning to improve just as that smoothing mechanism continues to work. Recommendations as far as evaluating long-term funding of the plans. We've done pretty significant benefit changes over the last 3 years. Those have helped. You need to keep in mind recent asset performance and then continue to monitor and assess the situation. On page 10, we show a year-over-year comparison of the fund actuaries' results for those funds that are using a level percentage of pay measure for determining the sufficiency measure. The key numbers that we're looking at here are the contribution sufficiency or deficiency measure. What is being looked at here is the difference between contribution rates that are set in statute versus the actuarially required contribution rate. And there is a sufficiency if the contributions set in statute are greater than the actuarially required, and a deficiency if they're less. Some of the key changes, so again, the 2013 legislation certainly has helped, as well as the asset performance has helped. On page 11, take a look at it in a little different perspective. The column on the left is the results on the actuarial value of assets basis. The column in the middle is looking at it on a market value of assets basis. So this kind of gives you a picture of using the smoothing mechanism, you haven't recognized all the asset gains that have happened. But without using that mechanism, you get a picture of where the funds would be if all those gains were realized. And then the column on the right takes into account kind of the long-term funding of where the fund is. The calculations that are performed by the fund actuaries take into account contribution rates that are in effect for the 2014 fiscal year, but don't explicitly take into account contribution rate increases that happen after 2014. So that's one of the adjustments that we made in the column at the right. The other adjustment that we've made is that there are two funds, Duluth Teachers and St. Paul Teachers, that have temporary state aid. That one contribution went in this past October, and another contribution is scheduled for the upcoming October. And after that, there's no more of those special temporary aids. So we've adjusted for that in the column on the right. So that gives you a picture of where the funded status as far as whether or not contributions are adequate over the long term. Questions? So page 12. Provides a little more detail about the cost of living adjustment mechanism and one of the issues that exists from an actuarial perspective. For several of the funds, there is an adjustment that is applied to the COLA when the funds return to financial stability. And within the statutes, financial stability is defined as when the market value of assets over the accrued liability is 90% or more. Based on the fund actuaries' projections, the assumption is for most of the funds that a lower COLA is going to apply for all future years. There are some issues, technical issues, with the way that determination is made and future measurements under the fund. The big question is, how should the COLA be measured when financial stability is going to occur at some point in the future? Do you assume the lower COLA now? At what point in the future do you assume that the higher COLA is paid? And how does that affect how the fund actuary calculates the different funding measures? And then there's also the kind of a secondary issue is that you could reach a situation where you're 90% funded on a measure, and if you start paying the higher COLA, then all of a sudden you're less than 90% funded. So you could have a situation like the paralocal correctional fund where the cost of living adjustment has gone up for 1 year, went back down the next, and then gone back up. So that's one issue that we would suggest that a resolution, either through statute or adjustment to actual standards of practice, would be used to address that situation. Switching gears, on page 13, looking at the supplemental contribution determined as a level percentage of payroll. This is an example where the fund's unfunded accrued liability is about $6 billion. The amortization method in this fund says that the annual payment in order to pay off that unfunded liability is about $400 million. Now, those determinations are made based on assuming a level percentage of payroll and a payroll growth assumption of 3.75%. So what happens over the amortization period is payments start at $400 million and then gradually over time increase to be a little bit more than $1 billion. With that level of payment, eventually over the 26-year period, the unfunded liability is paid down to zero. In the graph in front of you, you see the solid red line that goes up for a little bit of period of time and then eventually comes down all the way to zero. One thing I want to point out about that piece is that with this amortization method, there's a short period of time in which your unfunded liability is actually increasing. Sometimes that's called negative amortization. So you have a situation where payments under this schedule are not actually paying off the unfunded liability immediately, but do so over a long period of time. The potential issue with this method comes into play if your payroll growth assumption is not realized. And what's shown on this chart is if, rather than 3.75%, the payroll growth is only 2.75%, the amortization payments, rather than increasing to a little bit more than $1 billion over that 25-year period, ends up only coming up to $815 million. Because those payments aren't as high as what you were expecting, the results shown in the top part in the dotted red line are that you don't actually pay off your unfunded liability over your scheduled payment period, and you end up with a liability that's still about $4 billion. Where that's potentially an issue is kind of looked at a little bit of detail on page 14. So we've gone back and looked at historical payroll growth increases for several different funds. And over different time periods, in general, the current payroll growth assumption has not been met, except for the para, police, and fire fund. So there is concern that the current methods that are being used, combined with the assumptions, are not making adequate allowance for paying off the unfunded liability. And that directly ties back to looking at the sufficiency-deficiency measure. Yeah. If you're not on schedule, or your methods that you're using aren't going to pay off the unfunded liability, the measure that you're looking at, as far as one of the key measures, is not as precise as what would like it to be.
Mr. Herman, excuse me. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like some clarification, if we could, for the Commission's benefit. When we talk about the 3.75% payroll growth increase assumption, I'd like to know if that means an increase of 3.75% in membership or payroll increases or a combination of both in order to be able to achieve this outcome.
Is it annual
increase? Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, it's a combination of both. So this piece of the calculation looks at the total payroll of last year and assumes that that grows at 3.75% each and every year. So it's a combination of new members coming into the system as well as individual pay increases over a year-to-year basis.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, then, what does that look like in out years when we're growing the number of persons and growing the total compensation to persons? Don't we just kick that out even further because we have to have an increase in participants and an increase in payroll to be able to backfill on this? In other words, we're just kind of, I don't want to use the term kicking the can down the street, but it seems like we're maybe having to kind of always just keep chasing the same kind of a situation.
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's exactly what's happening. You're right on the nose.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I just want to ask the testifier to clarify when he said that's exactly what you what's happening. You've hit it right on the head. If you can just again, we are, that's just for my clarification, we are needing to continue to grow the number of participants and the wages that those individuals have in order to help us meet the unfunded liability. Is that correct?
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. So by making these assumptions, you are heading down the path where you're going in one direction. If you are not meeting those assumptions, it's like Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, you're going to end up somewhere else. And where you're going to end up is not paying off the unfunded liability by your statutory amortization date.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Not to drag up the nightmare of a couple of years ago when we had some bills that would essentially have reduced the number of state employees by 15%, if you remember the Downey bills. So let's say if we look at an assumption that we do become appreciably more efficient in government and that number, we could see some significant shortfall in unfunded liability or an increase in unfunded liability if we were to see an appreciable efficiency improvement in state government and we see the number of people paying into these pensions fall. Sort of like what's going on in Duluth right now. We see the number of people who are paying in going down dramatically, but yet the number of people that are that have payouts coming up. That's a long question. Tell me if you need to repeat it. It's as much a statement, but I mean, I think what I'm hearing is we need to feed this at a rate that's consistent with 3.75 to realize the assumptions that we have in terms of this paying the unfunded liability down to zero after 26 years or whatever.
Mr. Herman.
Chair, Representative Benson. So it's either putting more members into the system, giving them higher pay increases, or finding another contribution source.
Thank you. That helps me in terms of I've been advocating for the latter, or the second for some time, in terms of understanding our obligation to our retirees. We're walking a very fine line in terms of ensuring that 20 years from now we're going to have the kind of money necessary to meet our obligation. Thank you.
Please continue, Mr. Herman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 15, we provide a little bit of detail about the entry age normal method as it's used in the Duluth Teachers Fund. On this page, we are showing results from the replication valuation that we did last year. So the numbers are actually a year old, but the concept is the same. On the top, we show what the normal cost percentages and show the fund actuary's results compared to the approach that Milliman used. And then on the bottom, we are looking at the amortization payment, comparing the fund actuary's results to Milliman results. The difference that are underlying these two numbers is the way in which the entry age normal method is applied. Under the Milliman results, we are applying the entry age normal method for each individual member based on that member's benefit structure. That differs than the fund actuary's approach, where they are calculating the normal cost, assuming that it's the normal cost for new entrants, so people hired in the future. Generally, what has happened is that as time has gone by, future benefits for new employees are lower than for past employees. So applying the fund actuary's method, the normal cost is lower than it is under the Milliman results. And what the impact on the funding measure is that there's a cost shifting between calculating costs for future benefits compared to accrued liability. So under the fund actuary's method, there's a lower normal cost that's calculated, a higher accrued liability, so a higher unfunded accrued liability. In Duluth's situation, where there has been declining membership, that means that you are pushing a significant portion of the cost into the accrued liability and not having payroll in the future to fund it. So in Duluth teacher's situation, that particular approach to the method is something that we have an issue with. Any questions? Switching gears again, comments about the MRF division of PARA. And this relates back to the 2010 omnibus pension bill. The numbers on the left show where the fund is as of July 1st of 2013. There's about $300 million of unfunded accrued liability. There, between employer contributions and state aid, there's about $56 million of statutory contributions that are required to go in to the plan. Under item C, list the different pieces of payment that are the actual required contributions. You'll have to forgive me. I need longer arms. So that total required payment is about $33 million. So contributions are $22 million more than what are actually required. So it looks like the fund's in really good shape. Kind of hold that thought aside for a second and look over on the pieces that are on the right. The long-term plan for the MRF fund is that's going to be merged into PARA General. That merger happens when MRF fund is 80% funded. Given the current funded ratio of about 74.4% and the additional $22 million that are going into the fund, to us it looks like within the next 3 to 5 years, the MRF is going to be funded at the 80% level and will be merged into the PARA General Fund. So just a couple of pieces of information for you.
Would you say that again, please, Mr. Herman? Not the... how many years?
Certainly. We are projecting about 3 to 5 years. The MRF fund will be 80% funded, and at that time it will be merged into PARA General. Okay. Of course, that comes with all actuarial caveats that assumes that you earn the 8.5% return of the fund.
So that's 2018?
Yes.
We'll have to have cake. Please go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 17 is more of a early warning. The Actuarial Standards Board sets about standards that which practicing actuaries need to follow. They have a new standard that will first come into play for your July 1st, 2015 valuations, and that's specifically with regard to the interest rate. The new standard doesn't tell you what you have to use as an interest rate, but rather provides guidance to the actuary when they're doing calculations and producing reports. Right now, the current standard is an assumption is reasonable if it falls within the actuary's best estimate range. And the way most practicing actuaries interpret that standard is take a look at a plan's investment policy, develop some of their own economic assumptions, and then come up with a range that's between 25 and 75%. So if the assumption falls within that range, then it meets the standard and is reasonable. Under the revised standard, the definition of reasonable is adjusted so that reasonable assumption is one that has no significant bias. So that's an assumption generally somewhere around the 50th percentile. So about half the time you'd expect it to be below that assumption, and about half the time you'd expect it to be above that assumption. When we look at Minnesota's 8.5% long-term assumption, and depending on what economic models you use, that assumption may have some bias. And what that means in your situation, again, isn't that you have to change the 8.5% assumption. It's more geared towards what the individual fund actuaries are going to judge based on that assumption, based on the way they look at it, and whether or not they need to make additional comments on the report about that reasonableness of the assumption that is set in state statute. Now, this is a brand new standard. One of the questions that I expect to be answered over the next couple of years is, what is everybody else doing about it? At this point, I can't answer that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to digest that last series of comments. And with the revised standard, you'd indicated that the assumption would be that it'd be 50% above and 50% below that standard or that projection or assumption. What's the time period that's looked at? Is that a 5-year, a 10-year, a 20, a 30-year time period? And then secondly, maybe you can explain a little bit more about, for the Commission's benefit, 50% above, 50% below. Does the rate of assumption affect that 50% above and 50% below so that we almost would need to back into something that actuarially we would be able to over time statistically be 50% above and 50% below or standard deviations from the assumption?
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. So the two questions you asked, one was time period. Second was talk a little bit more about the 50th percentile and how that's determined. So the time period that typically looked at for actuarial calculations is not a 5-year time period, but it's much longer. The funding that we're doing is looking for over 50, 7,500 year time periods. So we have a much longer time frame that we're looking at when we're setting assumptions for doing funding calculations. Typically, somewhere around the 20, 25, 30 year time horizon is what we're looking at when we're setting those assumptions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, if we're looking at trying to be 50% above or in the 50% quartile or 50% range, it would seem to me that if we were to use something like, and I'll just use a standard, the S&P index over a period of time, which has been at around 9.1, 9.5%. So if that were to be the assumption, then we would say that over that 25-year period of time that the market would, that the assets would outperform the bogey of 9, 9.5%. Half the time it would be underperforming during that time. Is that correct?
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's correct.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So what would be the industry standard then that we should be looking at? Because you've indicated that the 8.5% assumption that the state of Minnesota is looking at right now, you're not commenting specifically on that. With your calculations, were you looking at long-term rates of return, for example, the S&P index, or were you looking at some other kind of standard to help us to determine that 50% quartile?
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, we would be looking at the investment policy, the way the funds are invested, taking into account what expected returns are over the long term based on the different asset classes, based on the asset allocation and diversity over time.
Thank you.
What was the last one, Mr. Herman?
And diversity over time.
Madam Chair, may I address the commission?
Mr. Hogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the commission. I'd just like to clarify our comments here are really to point out that, first of all, this has no bearing on what the state of Minnesota and the Legislative Commission is obligated to do. It's merely what the actuary is obligated under their professional standards to report on and comment about. Secondly, Milliman has not actually run a model or done any analysis to say whether or not the current economic assumption does have a bias or does not have a bias. It is merely a statement that, looking at what a lot of other funds use and what's out there, perhaps there is one, but there are many different economic models out there, and we're certainly not taking a position one way or the other that you have that currently with your assumption. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear, that we're just pointing out what the actuary's obligation is going to be come 2015 under their professional standards.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Not to prolong the topic, but I do, the gentlemen who are testifying tonight raised the issue that the revised standard would have an assumption that it'd be 50% above and 50% below the assumption over a long period of time, which we're talking about 25, maybe 75 or 100 years. I'm just trying to quantify what that means for the new standard when the state of Minnesota has to take that into consideration. That's the purpose for my questions on here. I realize that we didn't contract with your firm for the purpose of giving us an individual profile of how we're doing or how that bogey might be. I think it's very important that the new standard is going to be here, that people understand that the assumption now needs to be that 50% of the time it's above where you want to be, 50% of the time it's below, and that's going to create some whipsaws into the future for state pension assets, which we hope don't crash over time with the number of recipients who will receive pensions in an upswing, in a downswing, with being under that 50%, because 50% is an awful long time to be underfunded, particularly when you're starting to look at a large number of baby boomers and potential retirees, not only within the state of Minnesota, but other covered government agencies. And that's where I'm trying to drive to figure out what we need to be doing as a legislature and as a state on it. So.
And I noticed Mr. Hogan shaking his head up and down.
Madam Chair, yes, that's you're absolutely right that we are only pointing this out, but you do want to have assumptions that are reasonable, and certainly information that the actuary for a specific fund might provide under this requirement in 2015 is valid information for the commission to be aware of and hopefully does help guide them in setting the assumption that they feel is best.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for either testifier, then, honestly, I think you could have included that information about how the standard would change without including a bullet that says that we have a bias towards optimism. So I'm wondering what had compelled you to include that in a report, that essentially what you're saying now is that you're providing this as information for the future to understand the standards that will be used for this report. But I'm still intrigued by what compelled a bullet in a report, you know, that was going to be a matter of public record that says you may have some bias towards optimism. I mean, it's very important as a legislative body of making sure that we're doing things that are appropriate for these funds and the people that rely on them. So you haven't done an audit, but you still felt somewhat compelled to say, hey, folks, there may be – I'm using politician hyperbole here. You guys are far more accurate. But the fact is that you included a bullet here that says it was optimistic. So what compelled you to do that? Just your comparison about how we've done things or the fact that we have, like, we're expecting the third highest return in the country or something like that in terms of, you know, 8.5% compared to every other state?
Mr. Hogan?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think you hit the point with your last statement that, you know, we are aware of what the other public systems are using in their funding assumptions and the fact that this is at the higher end of what we've seen many of the other governments use and would probably be at the higher end of a model if we were to run it. Could potentially compel us to want to say in a report, if we were doing a formal report that you were adopting on the assumptions, to say that there could be a bias to that assumption. So certainly we're pointing it out that your rate, as you know, is higher than what a lot of other systems use. Does that mean you have a bias? Not necessarily, but it is at the higher end, and we acknowledge that, certainly.
Any other comments, Mr. Herman, about that, about Representative Benson's question? Or, yeah, it was the question.
Madam Chair, no, I think Bill has addressed that adequately.
All right. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, the rest of the comments that are in the report are detailed comments on each fund. I didn't intend to go through each of those, but if there was any questions, be happy to respond to any that might occur.
Members of the commission have any questions about the specific findings? Is there anyone in the room that wants to rise and question a finding that Mr. Hogan, Mr. Herman are here to explain? No one has any questions, Mr. Hogan and Herman, about a particular finding. Okay. All right. Any concluding comments?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, that summarizes our information, but we're very happy at a later date to address any questions that may come up after tonight. Certainly, we are happy to address any of those at any time. And we do thank the commission for allowing us to present these results and provide our information.
Is there anyone in the room that wants to respond to anything that's been said? Okay. If not, is there any commission member that wants to question anything further? Mr. Hogan, have previous reports been this picky?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, we have made some of the observations communicated tonight. We had communicated, maybe not quite as strongly, but we had communicated last year a few of them. Some of them are new. We've tried to highlight those items, in our opinion, that we felt should be highlighted and brought to your attention. From our position, this is the when we look at the information, we look at what we think should be important for the commission to see and address, and hopefully the commission will get value out of those comments.
And Mr. Hogan or Mr. Herman, in the last few reports, with the things that have been suggested or brought to our attention, then has any of our legislation addressed those concerns that you thought should be addressed, and where we've done a good thing, where the commission has done a good thing with their legislation?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, the legislation that was passed last year significantly improved the funding prospects of the funds, in our opinion, and I think Mr. Herman mentioned that as he was going through. We certainly think that improvement has occurred, and we certainly, it was not our intent to create a negative atmosphere or a negative feeling about the prospects of the fund, of the funds and where they're headed. We certainly feel that since the significant trials and tribulations of the 2008-2009 markets, the funds have definitely rebounded and improved from that point in time. So from our perspective, we're just trying to point out other items that should not be ignored going forward, because they're counterproductive to what you're trying to do, in our opinion. So things such as using amortizations that can't be made or where the assumption's not being met, well, does that mean the fund is going to collapse? Probably not, but it's counterproductive for where you're trying to get to, and so that's what we're trying to point out.
And we welcome those findings. Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. As long as the Milliman consultants are here, I wanted to acknowledge that we are continuing to work on an issue that was raised at the last set of commission meetings about valuing the post-retirement adjustment using our different adjustments now, the 1%, 2%, and Mr. Martin had raised this issue in a memo and asked that we had something put in statute that used what we are paying and our projected full funding date, and the actuaries and the fund directors have been discussing this, and we are still working on it. And I just wanted to acknowledge that our actuaries have been speaking to the Milliman actuaries, and we hope to have a recommendation to share with Mr. Martin and resolve this for the commission this session yet. So we'll continue to work on that and be ready soon, I'm hoping. Okay. I'm assuming.
And that is a good thing.
Yes.
People in this room are listening. And yesterday I heard of the richest person in the world having something over $50 billion. And I'm writing a letter now and bringing the attention of some of these things to that individual, because maybe he'll share. Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Herman. Thank you, Mr. Hogan. This report is received.
Thank you.
Oh, at just the right time.
Madam Chair, I thought you would have finished the meeting by now.
Not quite.
Full agenda. I could have stayed longer. All right, good evening, everyone. The next thing on the agenda, we have the O'Driscoll and Peterson bill, PERA. Mr. Martin, are you going to remind us of what this is about?
Yes, members, I can. Members, this would be item 3 in your packets on the tab. This has to do with PERA General. It's a question of retirement coverage. It applies to the St. Cloud MTC bus drivers. The factual situation is that since 1986, the St. Cloud Metropolitan Transit Commission has directly employed its bus drivers. Previously, they had retained an outside firm that hired the bus drivers. As such, the bus drivers who exceeded the salary threshold in PERA should have been in PERA general coverage. As a practical matter, only the on-call, the non-fixed route bus drivers in St. Cloud have been in PERA, and the fixed route bus drivers have been in the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund. There was not enacted ever an exclusion for the fixed route bus drivers, and that is what the piece of legislation seeks to do, to codify an exclusion in PERA law for the fixed route drivers, leaving them with their current pension coverage in the Teamsters Central States plan, leaving the non-fixed route bus drivers in PERA general.
So, members, I think tonight we can start to build our pension bill, and this could be the first one. Do we have... I don't know if we necessarily have a vehicle bill yet, but we could just say to incorporate into the omnibus pension bill. Are there any questions about this issue? Is there anyone in the audience who didn't get a chance to testify in the past that wants to weigh in either for or against? Representative.
Madam Chair, for your benefit and the benefit of the committee and the commission, I should say, is...
O'Driscoll. You guys shouldn't sit together.
Separate us.
Yes.
Immediate past director of the St. Cloud Metropolitan Commission, Bus Commission, and the current director here this evening, should members or others have questions. They did make the trip down today from St. Cloud to be available for testimony if they're called upon to provide further clarification or to answer questions.
They want that. And do you think they want to ask if they want to speak to it?
We have it. Someone wants to testify. We haven't heard from before.
Were you able to testify before and during
Madam
the hearing?
Chair, I was not.
Oh, why don't you go ahead then?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And state your name for the tape, please.
My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, representing all Teamsters in the state of Minnesota. I just want to...
Welcome, Mr. Reynoso.
Thank you. I just want to say that we are neutral on the bill, and this is certainly a unique situation where you had a private company that used to own this transit system and subsequently was purchased by the city of St. Cloud. These members had been in the Teamsters pension program for many years, and many of them had vested. So we opted in keeping them in this plan. So while we would love to have them in two pension programs, and I don't think that that's something we would be able to negotiate. So with that being said, while we are neutral on the issue, we understand that it does need to be codified into law.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. Mr. Martin informs me that we need to do 1A, the amendment, and we do have a quorum, so we can take action. Representative O'Driscoll, did you want to move the 1A amendment? Why don't you explain it to us? Or I can have Mr. Martin, either way.
Mr. Martin, if you want to go ahead, that'd be fine.
Members, this is something that I had observed. We do have in in statute some restrictions on establishing public pension plans beyond the ones that have been legislated, and restrictions on contributing to other pension plans. And those are contained in 350 in Minnesota statute sections 356.24 and 25. When we exclude folks but leave for other pension coverage, it's just tidying things up if we make the appropriate amendment to those provisions. And so that's what Amendment 1A does. It adds the, if you look on page 21 of the memo, it would be page 3 of the 1A amendment, you'll see at the end of a long laundry list, this would be number 515, which would permit the St. Cloud Metropolitan Transit Commission to contribute to the Central State Teamsters Pension Plan for its fixed-route bus drivers. And that takes care of tidying up this statute that generally restricts employer contributions to other pension plans.
And, Mr. Martin, while we're on the amendments, can you just tell us what the 2A and the 2-3 and the 3A are briefly?
Members, the 2A and 3A were intended as alternatives. PERA had presented to St. Cloud back in the summer of 2013 what they thought would be a resolution of this issue. It had never been put into potential statute language, mm-hmm. and so 2A does that. PERA apparently is not interested in pursuing that at this point. 3A was my attempt at if it was possible to fold all of the bus drivers, both fixed route and non-fixed route, that 3A would have all the bus drivers in St. Cloud in the Central State Teamsters plan.
Okay.
That would be changing their current situation.
Just so members know what some of the other options are, if they're interested. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Martin, I see in the original bill, the thing we discussed about on page 3 of the original bill, page 29 in the packet, the Carpenter's Local issue there. I'm fully cognizant of that Carpenter's Local 87 no longer exists. They've been merged into a different local number, and would this be appropriate time to or a place to put that number in there? And
sure.
So, Madam Chair, I will move that on 3.32 of the line 3.27. It's on the bill itself.
So, page 29 of your packets.
29 of the package to change local 87 to local 322. I think we've already got an amendment on the floor, but we could.
Is that only mentioned once?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So on line 3.27.
Yes.
Delete 87 and insert 322. Okay. Representative Nelson makes that amendment. Any comments or questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Sorry. We have 1A.
We have the 1A before us? I didn't really, no one really offered it. Yeah. We were talking about the three amendments.
I'm happy to offer the A1 and then take Representative Nelson's vote, Madam Chair.
Okay, then Representative O'Driscoll moves the A1 amendment, 1A amendment. Anybody in the audience want to comment? Any questions from the commission? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Nelson?
And Madam Chair, I'll move that on line 3.27 of the bill, strike 87 and replace it with 322. Insert 322.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And the bill is amended for the omnibus.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions on this bill? Then Representative O'Driscoll, do you want to make the motion or do you want me to state it?
I believe, Madam Chair, what you're looking for is to for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Or did you want to include it?
I think we can just put it in.
Okay.
Right.
Then I make the motion that we include House file 1873, Senate file 1943, and the 2014 omnibus pension bill.
Okay, you heard the motion. Any questions?
As amended.
As amended. Thank you very much. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, that's. I think we didn't approve the minutes. I assume you've all had a chance to examine them to make sure your names are spelled properly. Someone like to move approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Senator Rosen moves approval of the minutes from February 12, 2014. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, now we'll move on to number four in the agenda, Senate File 2148, Senator Westrum, and House File 1894, Representative
McNamer.
Thank you.
They're both here.
McNamer. We did have a hearing on this, but I don't believe Senator Westrum was here at that last hearing. Senator Westrum, would you like to make any? I'm sorry, Representative Murphy?
I was going to move that Senate File 2148, House File 1894, be included in the omnibus bill.
Is there any necessary amendments?
We're still in the Peterson bill.
Okay, no suggested amendments. Would anyone like to comment? Ms. Vanek, did you want to comment? And Senator Westrum, if you wanted to comment, you're welcome to do so.
I'll be brief.
Okay, you can join us at the table, and we'll hear from Ms. Vanek first.
Madam Chair and members, I am seeking advice from your staff on page 3 of the bill, on line 3.21, and then again on line 3.27. There is reference to the Stevens County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, and I read this to say that all future people will also be enrolled, and it is my understanding that the county only wants to take care of those individuals who were previously enrolled, codifying their coverage but not providing coverage for future hires. So the underscored language on those two lines, I believe, has to be removed. But I will defer to Mr. Martin on that.
Members, I would, well, at this point, I'm not sure I am the best person to characterize what Stevens County HRA wants to do. My discussion earlier today with the lawyer for the Stevens County HRA, who could not be here tonight because he works out state and had another engagement that he had to attend to, could not be here. They definitely wanted to take care of the folks who are currently in PERA, who are currently working for the Stevens HRA at a minimum, but he seemed to be of the opinion that they wanted to do it ongoing for any new hires that they currently have. That was the impression I had. I would look to the representative or the state senator to if they have a better understanding of what the HRA wants to do. If we don't want to do it for the future, our suggestion is just to pull Section 2 out of the bill. The only changes in Section 2 relate to Stevens County, and if neither are necessary, the whole section can go.
Oh, on session.
The whole section. Where does Section 2 start?
Madam Chair.
This is Representative McNamara?
Right.
McNamara.
Our bill is for just the three employees.
Just the three employees. Senator Westrum?
Well, Madam Chair, that's what I understand as well, that they're the ones that are caught in this lurch because erroneously the payments have been paying into PERA and they're now not eligible for any retirement. So that's my understanding. If we find out different, I guess we'll let you know. But that's how we were presented the issue.
Then Representative Murphy moves to delete Section 2. Is there anyone from the audience who wants to comment? Any more discussion? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Westrum, did you want to make any more comments?
You know what, Madam Chair, you're moving right along. I think more words will just cause delays.
Okay, someone want to move the bill as amended?
Aye.
Murphy, Representative Murphy. Then moves.
Renew my motion to Senate File 2148 and House File 1894 as amended be included in the omnibus bill.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Next we have number 5 on the agenda. If Mr. Martin wants to just... remind
Mr.
us,
Burek.
This bill? Mr. Burek wants to remind us what this bill is.
Members, this bill would add
I'm sorry, wouldn't add any positions to the MSRS board. What it would do is it would permit deferred members of the various MSRS plans to vote in board elections generally for the active member positions. Madam Chair, I would suggest it would be a good idea to consider this in tandem with number 9 on the agenda, since there are similar proposals, but they're heading in somewhat different directions. So you might want to hear both of those proposals before deciding what actions to take on either one of them. Item number 9 is a proposal to add a position to TRA's board that would be reserved for a retired member. So,
Mr. Barrett, why do you think they're heading in opposite directions?
Well, the first one is saying that we don't need more retiree representation on the MSRS board. What we need is more deferred member input by allowing deferred members to vote, whereas item number 9 on the agenda is saying that if you're a TRA member but you're a deferred member, there's no reason why we should extend a right for you to vote in any TRA board election, but we should have more retired member representation on that board.
So, Representative Nelson, do you feel like you're moving in two different directions here?
Madam Chair and members, the number 9 dealing with the TRA, it's a different board. There was not discussion of the members bringing this bill forward that of wanting to of discussing that. That wasn't what their intent was. What their intent was, they've had a similar bill in the past to have an additional member designated as that, and in the past, because they would have had to have an election between the election of that they have already, it got voted down. What they're proposing here is to add a member at the next election, so there's no additional cost to TRA to have the election. But they're saying that with the number of retirees that are out there and being served, that they would like to have another member on the board to express their opinions. But they did not address the deferred members at all. So it's just dealing with, they would like to have an additional retired member on
the board.
Sounds
like representation.
Yeah, more representation. And it deals with a number of people on it. But they didn't deal with, they weren't looking at or dealing with the deferred. And I can understand why the discussion about whether we want to have allowed deferred members to vote in all our pension plans, but that's not what this bill is dealing with. They're just asking to have an additional retiree on the board. And like I said, this time they're doing it so that it would fall in conjunction with their normal election, so there's no additional cost to the plan.
Okay, let's go back to number 5, Senate Bill 1326, House Bill 1410. We have had this discussion before about having a deferred member vote in board elections. I believe MSRS is supportive. Is there anyone who wants to comment on this bill? Any other discussion by members of the commission? Representative Murphy.
I apologize for not being here for the discussion on this the last time, but is there any additional cost for the deferred people to vote except for postage?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there is a slight additional cost, mostly for postage. It would be $17,000 to $18,000 every other year would be the additional cost just of holding the election.
Really, that much?
We have quite a few deferred members. We have close, it's about a dollar per person for the election, and we have about 17,000 deferred members in total.
We had a year.
And does every plan, will every plan then say they want their deferred people, or is this the only plan that where the deferred people do not vote?
Mr. Bergstrom, do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I am not, I think we may be unique in asking for this. I don't believe PERA deferred members vote, nor do I believe TRA members, deferred members vote. And the reason my board felt pretty strongly about it was back in 2010 when we adjusted their benefits. They had no voting.
Right, they got screwed.
No access to anything for the board. And I think what Representative Nelson said, they're active employees and they vote. Then they go out on deferred status and don't vote. They come back and retirees as vote. So what the other boards do, it's sort of up to them, but our board felt pretty strongly about it.
Okay, sorry, Representative Murphy.
Do you anticipate that, Mr. Bergstrom, or have they indicated, the people that you've visited with, about the employees that want to vote, do you anticipate that they will want retroactive changes to what we did in 2010 and 2012?
Senator Pappas, Representative Murphy, I think you had some testimony a few meetings back where someone wanted to undo. And so I would expect that they would have some interest in that. Quite frankly, that's no different than some retirees want to go and retroactive changes as well. I mean, it's going to get down to financing as to whether we can afford those changes or not.
And
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom,
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm sorry. Do you anticipate that? I remember when we were doing that in 2010, we were changing some benefits for the deferred or changing the amounts of interest paid to them. No one testified before the bill was passed. It was after the bill was passed that letters started coming and testimony came. So do you anticipate that the people that now do not vote, the deferred members that cannot vote, will pay more attention to the actions of the commission as legislation is passing through, because now they will have a vote?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I do believe that they would have more interest. We send them newsletters, but it would just give them access. When we have an election, they put a biographical sketch in. They explain what their philosophical views are. I think it would help engage our members.
Well, Madam Chair, one more question. That's Mr. Bergstrom, will a deferred person be able to run for election?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, not with this bill. This would just allow them.
Senator Goodwin?
Bill? Okay. I'll move that file 1326 to be included with the pension bill.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 1326, House File 1410, be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill. Is there any more discussion? Questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, next we have Senate File 713, number 6 on the agenda. Mr. Martin is issued. Mr. Martin's going to remind us this issue.
Members, the next three bills relate to Minsky, and this is the first of them. This has to do with Minsky currently has a temporary program where they can make payments either in cash or to the health care savings plan or both as an early retirement incentive. And that program expires as of June 30, 2014. And the request in the bill is to make the current temporary early retirement incentive permanent.
And I discussed this with Mr. Stanton, the 1A amendment, which would just extend the sunset date till 2017 so that we would come back and revisit this again in 5 years. Is that Mr. Stanton?
Madam
Chair, 2017 isn't 5 years from now.
It's only 3 years, right?
Yeah.
Was it the original?
The original was for five, so.
So we make it till 2019.
Members, on page 5 of the memo, which is the 1A amendment, on line 1.4, it specifies 2017, and the suggestion is to make that 2019. You can just incorporate
okay,
that.
Okay, so we'll just incorporate that into the amendment. Madam Chair. Senator Rosen.
So we're changing the date for a couple more years. Does the Minsky Board of Trustees, Mr. Staton, have to review that? I know that is the 2A amendment, but do they need to look at this? Mr. Staton.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, Minsky Board of Trustees supports this legislation. They designed the policy. The policy can vary by institution and by time and so forth in terms of how they have, how they offer early retirement incentives. I mean, it's basically designed to allow them to give targeted incentives as they're needed. So I think your question is, do they review it? Yes, mm-hmm. they do review it. And I think there was an amendment to...
2A.
That somebody
2A?
Had
the 2A, yeah.
2A mm-hmm. amendment to periodic, and we would be supportive of that also. I think they do review it, but I mean.
This is, I think, an either or. We could put just 2A, which requires them to review it, or given the fact that they do review it, we could do the 1A, which just extends the sunset date, so it'll be back for our review. Are you from Minsky?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Bill Brady. I'm the System Director for Employee Benefits and Compensation with Minsky. This is incorporated into our board policies, the BSEE program, and this program is actually reviewed by the Board of Trustees on an annual basis. They keep track of how many BSEEs have been offered by each institution and what kind of cost savings we're actually realizing with this program. We have seen fluctuations in its use, and we have some campuses who have actually not used it at all. It is left up to each individual institution to make decisions as to how best to use this program to effectuate whatever campus conditions they're experiencing in a given year. But we do review the program on a regular basis to make sure it is still effective for us.
So, Madam Chair, you could actually do both 1A and 2A. Because they are doing 2A anyway, but you could extend the date and make sure that they are reviewing it.
Okay. Up to the committee.
Madam Chair, I do have a question for Mr. Brady. Does Minsky Board of Trustees, are they in the pension plan?
No, they don't get pension.
Mr.
No.
Brady?
Just volunteer, basically. Yeah, they're volunteers, right.
Okay, someone want to offer the 1A amendment with the change to 2019? Senator Rosen moves the 1A amendment with the incorporated the change on 1.4 to 2019. Questions, comments? Excuse me?
Was it 2017?
We changed it to 2019. That was we incorporated that change. All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen?
Yes.
She wants to offer the 2A amendment, which is the one that, if you want to look at the language.
Periodic obligation. Madam Chair, the bill, if you look in the last page of page 10 of the packet, there is a... it isn't there. The current law requires the Minsky Board to put together the eligibility requirements, and the 2A amendment requires that they periodically revise as well as initially establish the eligibility.
Okay, Senator Rosen, Senator Murphy.
I'll wait till the amendment passes.
All right. Any more discussion on the 2A amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. On the bill, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Brady, Madam Chair, Mr. Brady, I'm asking this based on your comments about what monies are saved for. Do you offer the early retirement incentives solely for cost savings to the MNSCU?
Mr. Brady.
To the individual university or college that makes the offer?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I would say that over the past few years, as we have seen the economic downturn, that has surely been a primary focus of as cost savings. But this is actually a very it's a program that allows us a great deal of flexibility. So it allows us to target employee groups. It is not limited to faculty. It actually carries forward to all of our employee groups, and it allows us to do something very large. We might target an entire campus where every member of the institution is eligible. Or at least it is open to them. There's still eligibility standards that they would have to meet per board policy. But we could also limit it to a particular department. If we see fluctuations in enrollment and we know that a department has seen declining enrollment over a significant period of time, we might be able to target this incentive towards retirement eligible individuals within a department. So it does have some flexibility. We are using it in a variety of ways. Cost savings is always a central concern of ours, and we want to make sure that any money that we're expending to incent individuals to retire early is actually producing us some cost savings.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brady, then, thinking about the answers that you just gave me, then, do you find that some programs then, or some campuses then, are offering these wonderful early retirement opportunities, and then the system is hiring less permanent people or less people or more people that do not qualify for pensions in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I would say that that's probably that would not be our experience. There are many of these positions that we incent in early retirement we actually do not fill. Those that are filled are most usually filled by a full-time individual that perhaps is coming in at a lesser salary just because of the experience difference of a 30-year employee versus a one-year employee. And in our system, we do have the dual retirement systems. Many of our employees are participating in a defined benefit plan, whether it be MSRS or TRA, and many of them are participating in our own defined contribution plans. But at a 0.25 FTE is our qualification in order to qualify for retirement. A good percentage of our employees actually are qualifying to participate in a retirement plan and therefore getting the employer contributions towards that retirement plan. I don't have the numbers in front of me regarding the use of adjunct or part-time instructors, but our data for the BSEE program suggests that those are not being replaced by merely just adjuncts or part-time workers.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanton.
Madam Chair, for the committee, I represent the union, and that certainly we would be objecting if that was the case. These have been really a win-win situation because when we have downsides, right now we've had falling enrollments at three of our universities. They're laying people off. If they can provide an incentive for somebody at the top to retire early, it saves almost twice as much money as laying off the person at the bottom typically that's just coming in new. And so for us, it's a job saver. For the younger people, and MNSCU over the last 4 years estimates that they saved about $18.6 million by using early retirement incentives to do the reorganizations. And so, had they not saved that, the cuts would have been $18.6 million deeper into the staff. So, that's why we're very supportive of it, even though it gives administration far more flexibility than they've ever had with any other early retirement incentive. Thanks.
Any more discussion? Does someone want to move the bill? Neither of the authors are here.
I move that Senate File 17. Excuse me.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Benson.
Okay, I know that in our first discussion about the bill, it was to eliminate the sunset entirely, mm-hmm. and we had some discussion. I had an amendment 3A. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see 3A and whether or not Mr. Martin has distributed that. But
you have to tell Mr. Martin he has permission.
Okay. So what the amendment does, Madam Chair, is to require that that Minsky come to the commission every other year on the odd year to give us a review of the implementation of the system. So originally it had been as a way to keep a handle on how they're using it, what they're doing, some of the questions that Representative Murphy asked. To give us a review period, you know, every other year. You know what? As it stands with the, since we've now modified it, so it's 5 year. Certainly, I don't know if it's as important, but at least this gives us a window into how they're using this policy, and that's 3A. I don't know if members have had a time to look at the amendment or not.
Mr. Brady, do you have a copy of the amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. Members of the Commission, we have reviewed this. We are happy to appear and discuss our usage if that's how the Commission, if that's what the Commission deems appropriate. We do currently file reports with the Legislative Library that goes over the BSEE usage, but we would be happy to provide more information if necessary.
Any discussion? Anybody else in the audience? Representative Benson?
Well, I don't have another question, Madam Chair.
You want to move your amendment?
Yeah, I would like to move the amendment and that it be included.
All those in favor of the 3A amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. On the bill?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 713, House File 872, as amended, be recommended to pass and moved into the omnibus pension bill.
For each amendment,
he didn't even say aye on both sides.
I said aye.
There were no ayes on the House side.
Oh, yeah, no, I said aye.
My amendment. He said aye.
Is that enough? Do you want? You need to have four.
I think I heard Senator Nelson. I mean, Representative Nelson say.
No, I didn't say anything. I was still thinking about it.
Well, all right, let's go back.
I think it's left to the hearing of the chair myself.
I don't think I voted. okay, let's go back on the 3A amendment, and we can slow down a little bit and have a little more discussion about. I did say it passed. But I've been challenged on that, and it was whether there were four ayes on the House side. I think there were four ayes on the Senate side. So maybe Representative Benson needs to be a little more persuasive with your colleagues.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity. And it simply is a matter of allowing for the Minsky folks to come back every other year to give us a report on how they've used that. And originally the amendment was written because we had actually said that we were going to remove the sunset completely. Okay. This would just give this commission an opportunity to look at how they've used this as a way to control expenses. I understand this is a defined contribution in terms of oversight. It's not like that pension fund is going to go belly up because we didn't. But this does give us a window into how they've used it to control their expenses.
Well, I'm pretty easygoing, but I think that if the chair of the Pension Commission invited Mr. Brady to come and give a report, they would come. know, I don't know if we need legislation to compel them, but I could go either way on it, members. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And having sat through a number of meetings with the governor's staff regarding Unsession and some of the stuff that they're, as part of that they're trying to make things work smoother and to save some money, is limiting some of these reports back to us, and we've objected to some of them. I guess along that line, I guess that's why I didn't say aye or nay, because I was still thinking. By putting the five-year sunset on it, they're going to have to come back to us and review it. So we've already set up a review process for them to come back to us. I don't know if this is redundant, I guess, is the question I have in my mind, or if this is putting more value into it. I don't know. So that's where my mind is at right here. And I guess I don't object to having them come back, but again, like I said, I think if the chair of the Pension Commission asked them to come back and give us a report on what they're doing, I think they'd be willing to do that. I think Mr. Brady stated that they file a report on their usage of this with the legislative library already, so I guess I don't know if this is being redundant and repetitive and redundant or not.
Representative Nelson and I don't want to sit in more meetings of unsession meetings, going back and making and deciding, or Representative Murphy to delete a lot of language that we decide is unnecessary. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd like to just ask our two testifiers, Mr. Brady and Mr. Stanton, if they could tell us if in their planning and in personnel planning and what have you, do you see more in a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 5 year planning process that you would need to have something like this? I'm intrigued by hearing back from you so that maybe we can get some best practices and apply it in other areas or provide modifications for you. My hunch is that if you needed modifications, you'd come back and visit with us. But I guess I'm wanting to make sure that if we're looking at a timeline here for planning where people are talking about, okay, in 3 years I'd like to leave and I'd like to know that this program is available versus it's on again, off again with a light switch kind of a thing. And I guess I'm looking to the two of you and from your respective corners on this to share some insight with us to help us make the decision on some of these things.
Mr. Brady.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think from our perspective, the longer it stays in statute, the more at least we know that it's there and we know that we have that option available to us should we need it. We do planning for personnel. Ideally, we plan years ahead and we see where trends are going. Unfortunately, sometimes enrollment fluctuations can be fast and furious, and we have to be able to respond to that. This is a program that actually allows us to respond relatively quickly if a campus would deem it necessary. And frankly, it's a lot quicker than the layoff process for our faculty, which has a significant notice period. So this is a program that allows us to be a little bit more flexibility than we would otherwise have just with the traditional options that we have for personnel reductions.
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. I do like the idea of hearing some periodic updates when the commission and the chair may want to have those, because, again, this may be something that we would want to look at applying in other areas, perhaps University of Minnesota systems or other systems that might be similar to this. And so I guess I would defer to Representative Benson as to what his wishes are, and as it is his amendment. But I do think that any time the chair of the pension commissions would ask for someone to come who has jurisdiction in this, they probably will be one of the first people to be here ready to testify, my opinion.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair.
Sorry, I said O. Nelson.
O.
Representative Nelson. It's almost St. Patrick's Day.
The Irish on my mother's side would be proud of that. But anyway, be that as it may, I don't have an objection to it. I just, like I said, I don't, having sat through the meetings, I don't want to see us coming back 2 years from now or 3 years from now when the governor's staff saying that this is a unnecessary and redundant, that we want to get rid of it. So, I mean, I agree that it's good that we have transparency and know what they're doing with it so that we're moving forward. I guess it's just whether we have enough with the five-year sunset, they're going to have to come back and justify it again anyway. So I don't know if it's – that's where I'm at. Okay.
Representative Benson, do you want to try your amendment again?
No. Madam Chair, honestly, the amendment was originally intended because we were going to eliminate the sunset. day period. And now we've added. I have a little bit of heartburn about a five-year stretch without having anybody. I honestly don't believe that unless it's brought to us that there's an issue, which it could, that as a chair you're going to remember that we haven't heard from them in 4 years and say, hey, would you like to see what's going on? So this was just an attempt to say, hey, listen, you know, every 2 years it doesn't hurt to at least hear from these folks about how the policy is being administered. So that's what it was about. So certainly if I got enough votes, I'd like to see it added on. Otherwise, I wouldn't have, you know, had it drafted in the first place. But I also don't have any heartburn, you know, about it not passing with the fact that we have 5 years. I just wish, you know, that we'd have a review.
Well, we'll tell Mr. Martin to make a note of it. So in 2 years, he'll have his successor. Will remind
Madam Chair, I withdraw.
Whoever the chair is, it could be your chair.
I withdraw the three amendments.
If you're the chair, Representative Benson, you'll have to remember.
Can you move that chair to Washington, D.C.? No.
Anything else on Senate File 713? I think we had who offered that amendment, Senator Rosengen? All right. Then any other questions?
No.
Representative Murphy, did you have something?
Madam Chair, I would just like to, I will keep track of this now and commend Representative Benson's offer of 46 words to on session.
All right. As he undid his amendment.
Thank you, Representative Benson.
Representative Rosen moves that Senate File 713, House File 872, as amended, be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus pension bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Moving on to number seven, Mr. Stanton, why did you go away? And Mr. Martin, remind us a little bit about this one.
Yes, members, Senate File 764, this is item 7 in your packets. It relates to the individual retirement account plan TRA coverage within MNSCU. When professors and similar staff at MNSCU are employed, they have an initial choice of whether they're going to be covered by IRAP or covered by that's the individual retirement account plan, a defined contribution plan, or be covered by a TRA, a defined benefit plan. For a period of time, some members have had a chance upon achieving tenure to have a second opportunity to elect whether or not they want IRAP or TRA for their ongoing pension coverage, and that was limited to faculty members who were hired before June 30, 2014. And this bill would do away with that closure date and would have this second opportunity election then be made permanent. So MNSCU faculty upon tenure, irrespective of when they were hired, would have a second chance to choose between IRAP and TRA.
And Mr. Martin, the 2A amendment?
The 2A amendment is strictly technical because this bill was introduced in 2013. The effective date doesn't work unless we change the dates, and that's what 2A does to make it 2014 for the effective date.
So Representative Nelson moves the 2A amendment, technical amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Mr. Stanton, Mr. Nelson.
Just a review for those people who weren't here at the last meeting. The higher education faculty, most of them are covered by a defined contribution plan, but they have the opportunity, and just because that's the norm in higher education, almost everybody in higher education has a defined contribution plan. But they have the opportunity at the time of reaching tenure to exercise the right to buy into TRA. If they buy into TRA, they buy in at full actuarial cost. Actually, not that many actually do the buy-in. I think we had 1,015 people that reached tenure in Minsky over the last 5 years, and 92 of them actually switched over. One advantage to you as a commission is before we had this, a lot of times we'd have people wanting to approach legislators with individual bills, saying, I didn't quite understand the choice. This gives them plenty of time to understand the choice and proactively buy in.
Mr. Stanton, typically how many years go by before a faculty gets tenure?
At state universities, it's about 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So what, on average, does it cost them to buy into TRA?
Depends, Madam Chair, depends on their age. I mean, it's an actuarial calculation, and they buy in at whatever that calculation. And the calculation is in statute based on their age and so forth. It can be quite expensive if they're an older person to buy
in. They
have
to pay both the employer and the employee?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's full actual value. It's not
full
based
actual
on contributions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say. Mr. Thompson, on the behalf of TRA, did you want to comment?
Yes, Luther Thompson on behalf of TRA. We do support this. We had about, Mr. Stanton said, 92 in the last 4 or 5 years that took advantage of it out of about 200 who applied. We've certainly addressed the administrative issue. We do this. I think the number of people just inquiring about it has certainly decreased. But I think the primary group we're looking at here are really the technical college, the two-year faculty people. We addressed the issue previously in terms of counseling, where we got all of the new employees that had prior service in one of the three major funds defaulted to TRA. This really corrects another problem when you have the HR directors at the two-year campuses. Sometimes they're not the most knowledgeable about pensions. And because it happens early on in the career, when the person gets tenure or their career status, they're better able to make this decision. And as been noted, it's full actuarial value. So we don't think it's adverse to TRA. And it is a sizable amount, and it's mostly the early career people that do it.
Okay, any other comments from the audience or discussion from the commission? This has been amended. Someone want to move this bill?
I'll move Senate file or House file 871 as amended to be included in the omnibus pension bill.
Representative Nelson moves that Senate file 764, House file 871 as amended, be recommended to pass and included in the omnibus pension bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And then number 8, we're going to have to tell Representative Kahn that we defeated all her bills.
Mm-hmm. Members, if you turn to tab 8 in your packets, this is Senate file 765, House file 870. Again, has to do with Minsky. It applies, it's a provision that applies to those Minsky individuals who are covered by either MSRS General, TRA, or one of the First Class City Teacher plans. There are special provisions that were enacted sometime, I believe, in the 90s that allows a professor or a faculty member to retire and to return to work without having the usual limitations that apply to them. The amount was initially $35,000 per year. It was reset several years ago at $46,000 per year. This proposal is to increase that amount above $46,000 to an amount equal to 2/3 of full-time employment. That's the maximum employment that a retiree can come back under this program. There's one technical amendment. That's the 4A amendment. Again, this bill was introduced in 2013, and we need to update it for 2014. And then there are substantive amendments, in some cases alternatives. 1 and 2 are alternative ways to reset the amount if you don't want to do it as a formula as proposed. And 3A adds a restriction that no one can utilize this special reemployment benefit if they received one of the early retirement packages that we dealt with in the two bills back.
Okay, so Mr. Stanton, we discussed putting a dollar amount in instead of the two-thirds.
Yes, Madam Chair, at the last meeting we had proposed two-thirds because then it wouldn't have we wouldn't have to come back and keep adjusting the dollar amount. But a TRA said that they preferred a dollar amount, and the dollar amount, if you just went with the CPI, the dollar amount would be $62,000. And so I guess we're agreeing with TRA rather than the two-thirds to that we'd prefer to just go to 62,000.
Oh, that is the 1A?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that was the 1A.
Members, what Mr. Stanton just described is what's contained in the 1A amendment, I believe.
Yes.
That's fine.
Okay, if it's okay with the members, why don't we do the 1A amendment if that's the preferred option?
I'll move the 1A amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the 1A amendment. Is there any discussion? Anybody from the audience? All those in favor say aye.
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 Those nay. Motion prevails. Then
the 4A amendment
is the technical.
Is the technical to update the effective date to make it consistent with this year, not 2013.
Representative Nelson moves the 4A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And members, what about the 3A amendment? Do we have any comments from Mr. Thompson or Mr. Stanton?
No. Madam Chair, this program has been around for 20 years, and we've never had a restriction like this. I don't know of a single case where anybody did get a early retirement instead of and then enroll in this program. Prefer not to have the amendment. If you do have the amendment, we'd prefer to put a period after 136F481 because that's what refers to the early separation incentive that you just discussed two bills earlier. My concern is, you know, for instance, we have in our contract a provision to that if a person gives their notice by October 15th that they're going to retire at the end of the year, that they'll get a two-step increase. That is basically so that they have time to do a search for to refill the position. I would hate to have this be interpreted as prohibiting that and interfering with our contract. So certainly don't have a problem with up to the language up to 136F.481, but would prefer not to have the rest of it.
Members, if you'd like to do what Mr. Stanton just described on page 1, lines 3, 8, and 13, do away with the or at the end of the sentence. And then delete lines 1.4, 1.9, and 1.14. And put a semicolon after 481 in lieu of the or on 1.3, 1.8, and 1.13. So then we just read, was not a recipient of an early retirement incentive under section 136F.481.
So do members want to do that, even though Mr. Stanton's not aware of it ever happening? Just a little safeguard.
I so move.
Okay. Representative Rosen, Senator Rosen moves the 3A amendment as amended to delete 1.4, 1.9, 1.14. It wasn't really officially amended. It was unofficially amended. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right.
Conclusion.
Just to finish that. Yeah. All right, any other discussion? Someone want to move the bill? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, does what we're doing here have any precedent to be considered by any other plan?
Members.
Mr. Martin.
I think there is some potential precedent. The $4,600 figure became precedent for TRA in changing its statute. Its reemployment limitations now have a a $46,000 limit or figure built into them that was probably inspired or somewhat impacted by this.
And so it very well may be likely that other plans are going to come and ask for something to be changed to the $46,000 limit.
Representative, I would think TRA and the First Class City Teachers, where we've already captured what was allowed in Minsky to be allowed in the K-12 systems, may well do that. It would be more likely. We have not seen any similar interest in PERA or MSRS, so I would not think it likely that this change alone would trigger that.
Maybe then, if this goes on tonight, then maybe the other plans that are still here could talk to their board about it to see if they're going to.
We have Mr. Thompson sitting at the
come
table.
Before.
If they did it before, TRA. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comment, Mr. Thompson?
Luther Thompson, TRA, Madam Chair. I don't think TRA has any intention of raising the $46,000 limit for our school teachers. And the bill we were talking about here only pertains to those Minsky folks who were enrolled in TRA. There is no limit for the majority of the Minsky faculty that are in the IRAP. And I guess I would just note on the disqualifying early retirement, we do have an exclusion for TRA. If you enter into an early retirement incentive package, you cannot go back to that school district.
Madam Chair.
I'd forgotten that part.
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Stanton.
And I just jogged my memory. Minsky also has a board policy that if you take an early separation incentive, you can't come back and be rehired also.
So, Mr. Thompson, who would likely benefit from this provision? Are school superintendents? Sometimes they make quite high salaries and they have to retire, and then sometimes they're enticed to come back because there's a shortage of superintendents, sometimes for a year in a transition situation.
Luther Thompson, Madam Chair. Certainly anybody, you know, the more highly compensated people are those that are going to have some of their earnings withheld for a year. It's really not, they don't lose anything. They still get the money back. It's just set aside. It's kind of held over from the period of time when actually you lost part of your pension if you exceeded the limit. So, it's one of those issues. We have a higher limit because we had some members in Minsky, and, you know, the $46,000 seemed to, you know, appropriate. There are a lot of accounts we would just as soon not have, really.
A lot of account. What do you mean by
these earning limitation accounts? You know, we withhold the money.
Oh, yeah.
And then we ended up just paying it back. Right. And it used to be that they were getting, you know, the 6% interest on it. So we never really understood why they objected to it. And even now, they get the money back, so we don't really see the reason for trying to avoid the earnings limitation.
They do.
Yeah, and Duluth and St. Paul did that last year.
Any other comments? You want Ms. Vanek to comment? Ms. Vanek?
I think she wants to talk.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair and members, with respect to the question about the other funds, the average salary in our general plan for our members is $36,000, so that's not a threshold we want to meet. I can tell you that we've done a study on reemployed retirees. We have some very different approaches, and they vary from what the League of Minnesota Cities and the counties would prefer, so we have made a commitment to work with them over the summer and hopefully arrive at a different approach that would fit our membership. So we're not interested in joining this bill at this time.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, we are not interested either. We have two programs. We have if someone wants to work full-time, they can come back and earn up to $15,000. I think it's $100 in some sense. And then we suspend their benefits. We also have a phased retirement program where they can go to work half-time or less. And they seem to be working. We have no desire to be part of this bill. at this point.
Okay. Someone want to move the bill? Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 765, House File 870, as amended, be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus bill. Any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, now we're going to move on to the new bills. House File 2179. Mr. Bierick.
This House bill is a proposal that would increase the size of the TRA board from 8 members to 9 by adding an additional elected retiree position. That would be for a 4-year term starting in 2015. The policy issues raised by the memo are noted in the executive summary or somewhat more detail in the memo itself. Let me mention a few of them. First one I'd mention is the second one noted in the executive summary, and that is adding another retiree position has the effect of diluting the influence of positions representing the broader public interest while giving greater emphasis to TRA retiree concerns. And specifically what I'm referring to is that right now on TRA's board there are 3 appointed members, and those appointed members are the Commissioner of Management and Budget, Commissioner of Education, and a representative of the Minnesota School Boards Association. Now, presumably those 3 appointed members...
Who appoints those? Mr. Barrett, do you know?
I believe in the board membership provision, they are specifically named.
Okay.
The individuals could...
Or ex officio. Mm-hmm.
Members, the individuals specified there could name someone to sit on their behalf, designate someone, but basically it's a representative of those organizations.
Okay.
And the point that I'm trying to make is that those appointed members represent the broad public interest in terms of state finance, state budgeting, and broad educational policy, whereas the elected members, since they are elected active members of TRA or elected retiree members of TRA, are... bound to be more focused on the immediate concerns of that constituency. So if you add another elected member position, and in the case of this bill, it's adding a retiree position, it does have the effect of watering down the influence of those 3 appointed members because the balance is upset a bit. Number 3, I pointed out earlier that there are some at least differences in what's happening here versus what the commission recommended to pass for the MSRS board. Number 4, this proposal could encourage similar requests by other groups seeking representation. Specifically, in 2005, the commission considered a Senate file and a House file, which would have added to TRA's board a specific position reserved for a person licensed by the Minnesota Board of School Administrators. It's possible that if you take action on the bill currently before you, that will encourage similar requests, either renewal of that request or similar request by other specific either employee groups or employer groups who may want direct representation on this board. And I also point out that the commission has heard a bill comparable to what you now have before you back in 2009. That was Senate File 1601 Olson, House File 1793 Nelson. And the commission heard that on several occasions, wound up not taking any action. That bill was eventually withdrawn from commission consideration. There are a few amendments there for your consideration. with those comments, I would turn it back to the chair.
Why don't we call, there aren't any immediate questions, why don't we have the testifiers come forward? Mr. Leathers and Ms. Beaver, whoever else is here to testify, please. Who wants to go first? All right. Mr. Leathers.
Madam Chair, Commission members, executive staff, my name is Don Leathers. I'm here on behalf of the Retired Educators Association of Minnesota, or REAM. I'd like to thank you for hearing my testimony. I'd also like to thank you for your good work during the interim between sessions to get to listen to stakeholders and advance legislation like you're doing tonight for the current session. We're also fortunate to have a legislative commission in this state. If you remember, there was a testifier earlier this winter who said some states don't have legislative commissions, and he commended this commission on doing their due diligence. I'm here tonight to speak in support of adding a retiree to the TRA board. That's House File Number 2179. I'm here on behalf of REAM. Representative Nelson earlier mentioned that he'd been approached by a couple of REAM members, President John Fisher, Executive Director Chuck Helley, and I would suspect that maybe Kurt Hutchins, a former Executive Director of the TRA board. They've all spoken to legislators about this issue. It's near and dear to their hearts. If you'll let me dabble a little bit in history, I'd like to go over where we've gotten with the commission over the last 100 years. The original board was established in 1915. There were five members, three state officers, and two teachers were elected. In the 60s, the board was expanded to seven members. In 1977, the legislature expanded the TRA board to eight members by adding a retiree. The current board composition of eight members, there's four elected members. There's three ex officio members that were mentioned earlier by Mr. Burick, and then there's one retiree. Composition has been in place since 1977. The composition of the board has evolved over time, but so has the number of retirees in TRA. There's a chart in one of the analyses that you've gotten. In 1998, there were 68,000 active members and 26,000 retirees for approximately a 39% ratio. In 2008, the numbers moved from 76 and 46,000, respectively, for a 61% ratio. And in 2013, that ratio was about 74%. So there are more retirees today than really ever. Also, throughout those 33 years, the ratio between active members on the board and retiree members on the board have been by law 25%. We at REAM believe by adding a retired member that number should go to 33%. And because of the numbers of retirees, we don't think that's unreasonable. Mentioned earlier where there were many stakeholders in the past who have asked for inclusion into the TRA board. School administrators, the faculty at Minnesota State Colleges and University or MinSCU have asked to have their constituency represented more fully on the board. The truth is, in our opinion, that these constituencies, by running for a retired position, or as in Representative Nelson's proposal, positions, that they can more adequately be represented on the TRA board. I'll give you an example. Last winter, there were three candidates who were running for the TRA board retired position. The REAM Executive Council invited each of them to come down to the Twin Cities and be interviewed by us, and then we'd make a recommendation to a rank and file. One of the candidates was Marty Zins, the incumbent. Two of the other candidates were high school administrators, one from northern Minnesota and one was an administrator from South Suburban area. If one of these individuals would have won the election, he would have been able to represent the high school administrators more fully, and I'm sure the same could be said for Minskew participation. Some people might maintain that a nine-member board might be too large, but the analysis that I read recently by the executive staff for the Legislative Commission found that the size of the MSRS and the PEAR boards are 11 members each, and that the Duluth and St. Paul boards have 9 and 10 members respectively. In fact, in 2012, the Legislative Commission on Pension Retirements went from 10 members to 14 members with the idea that it was a good opportunity for members of the legislature to get better hands-on information about the value of public pensions and also how they could represent more Minnesotans by doing that. We feel that this holds true also for a retiree on the TRA board. In closing, I'd like to thank you for listening carefully to my testimony. We believe that adding a second retiree to the TRA Board of Trustees is a good, solid proposal because of the increased numbers of retirees over the last 33 years. We believe that an added retiree means representation and not necessarily added influence. We also believe in the percentage of 33% between retired and active members on the board. And we believe that another retiree will give additional stakeholders a say in the activation of the plan and also allow retired retirees a greater voice in pension reform in the future. And I'd like to thank Representative Nelson for sponsoring this bill on the House side. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Do you have a cost?
Madam Chair.
How much this would cost per year?
Mr. Leathers.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. I had when I came to the meeting, but after listening to Mr. Bergstrom from MSRS, he said he had 18,000 voters and $1 a ballot, and we have 56,000 members, and each one of them gets a ballot, so I suspect that could be a number, but I'm not, that's not at all official. I just,
it's the normal election.
Is that a fair thing to say?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Beaver?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I think
just
that
say your
the
name
election,
again for the tape, please.
I'm sorry?
Say your name again.
My name is Joan Beaver, and I'm speaking on behalf of Education Minnesota Retired, and I'm in agreement with Mr. Leathers on everything he said, except that the cost of an election in this case, I believe, would be there are elections for the board all the time, so this would just be one more name on the ballot, not an additional mailing.
It's not a special election.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I want to
say. That's what you're going
to
say, Representative Nelson.
Representative
Murphy.
Madam Chair, I didn't mean the cost of the election. I meant the cost of having another board member on the board.
Per diem expenses.
And what if that board member lives in Warroad?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Representative
Leathers.
Murphy, I would suspect that mileage would be involved. I drove 104 miles to this meeting tonight, and I get compensation from Ream, so I'm sure that the board members are compensated for their travel. I know they have a lunch for them at the TRA board meeting, and maybe they also go to seminars and conferences, which would be part of being a board member.
And I'd like to know what a cost of a member is.
Mr. Stoffel, are you at the table to address that?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Stoffel, Deputy Director of TRA, and cost of a member of a board member sitting on the board. I think the gentleman describes it pretty much in full. There's mileage. There's incidental costs for attending board meetings and then conferences. There's a statute in Minnesota law that requires trustees to have adequate training and be expert in the the dealings of the board. So we do encourage our board members to attend conferences. I think you can figure around $3,000 for a conference, airfare, lodging, that type of a thing, two or three night, something that's very pertinent to what they do. That could be once a year. Not every board member goes every year, but those are the kind of costs we're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Stoffel, is there per diems provided to the board members?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, TRA has no per diems.
Representative Kahn, welcome back. I just wanted to, I'm sorry to tell you that all your bills were defeated because there weren't enough votes on the House side.
Well, too bad. It's the way life goes.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leather, so what did you say the last time? Did I hear you right? 1977 was the last time a board member was, you increased the number on the board?
Mr. Leathers?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, 1977 was the year that a retiree was added to the board. Since then, there have been no changes. There have been 8 members, 1 retiree, 4 actives, and 3 ex officio members, as described by Mr. Burek.
Thank you.
Ms. Beaver, did you get a chance to make your comments?
I can't. No.
Okay. Ms. Beaver.
Wanted to point out that we weren't going to have a special election, so I kind of jumped in. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thank you so much for considering this bill. I'm here to say that Education Minnesota Retirement is in full support of this bill, and we agree with the statement presented by Mr. Leathers. We feel that TRA members really picked up retired members along with active members, really took on responsibility in 2010 by supporting the changes that were made in order to make the sufficiency of the fund possible going forward. And, you know, that was a difficult thing for our members to do. It was difficult for the leadership of the organizations to do because it was a sacrifice. And we feel that, you know, in the future, we will be called upon again to make sacrifices when necessary and will be expected to act responsibly. And so we think that it's really important for retired members to have an adequate voice at the table. One of the considerations we feel is that when the board is meeting and issues come up, if you have one retired member there, they're on their own. They don't have a chance to discuss it with another retired member who might have a little different perspective, some different questions, some additional information, some input. I think we all understand the benefit of being able to discuss something when an issue comes up, to be able to discuss that issue with someone else who has an interest of the same group in mind. So we think that that's an important aspect of this, as well as the equity and fairness of it. As Mr. Leathers pointed out, the number percentage of retirees has increased dramatically, and so we think that the retirees need that voice at the table. I don't think it's a matter of I know it's not a matter of reducing the voice of anyone else on that board. It's a matter of adding a voice and adding a perspective. I had a couple of comments that I will just drop because I think Mr. Leathers has addressed them adequately. But I think another consideration is that right now we are very fortunate to have a member of the board who is very experienced, a retired member, who is very knowledgeable. She has served for many years, first as an active member and now as a retired member. And we feel that at some point, if she is no longer on the board, and then we bring a new person in, it would be wonderful to have someone else there to be able to add to the depth of understanding by the experiences. You know, I think our current retired member, she has an understanding of the history of the board, some decisions that have been made in the past, and the results of those decisions. So we think these are a couple of considerations that may not be addressed in any other way in your memo or in Mr. Leather's remarks that we hope that you will consider. And thank you for listening.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just something to my colleagues on the Pension Commission to consider on this. If we are going to expand the board, and I'm kind of pinging off of what Mr. Leather said, if the election would have been there were two administrators that were running for the position and had one of them won, that there wouldn't have been a teacher representative on there. My concern not is so much that we're adding another member. I just want this commission to know that next year we may have some people coming and saying, well, you know what, the elementary teachers who are retired aren't represented well on here, and the secondary teachers aren't represented as well as they might be, and, well, you know what, the Iron Range teachers aren't representative as well as they could be, and maybe we should have somebody from CD1 on there and somebody from CD7 on there. Maybe we should. So there is the potential for creep on this, and I really want us to look at this from a long-term perspective as to what the goal and the objective is. Again, I'm not opposed to the concept of expanding the board. I just want us to say, what's the next intersection down the road going to look like? If there's others that say, well, if we've expanded for those needs, are we going to expand for our needs? And when you get into the education realm, we could also, previous testifiers, hear some folks from Minsky who say, well, you know what, we're completely not represented the way that we think that we should be on there. And so I just throw that out as for discussion and consideration for members of the commission when making the decision on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Murphy.
Thank you very much. Ms. Beaver was talking about representing Retired Education Minnesota. Does Active Education Minnesota have an opinion?
I can't speak, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone here from Education Minnesota that would like to address that? Do you have a position on this bill?
I'll see if anybody's in the hall.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, and I guess as long as we're asking for opinions, I think we get TRA to come up and see what their opinion is, express what they're,
Mr. Thompson?
If they support or, just, or, not, or do not.
Luther Thompson, representing TRA. The board discussed this. The board's official position is they took no position. They are deferring to the Pension Commission to decide sort of on the merits of sort of the size and whether or not, you know, another retiree would be put on there. For all of you, you know, you've raised the issues about other members. Certainly the retirees are a growing percentage of our membership. But, you know, as fiduciaries of the fund, all members represent everyone. There was a period of time in the last decade when three of the four actives were retirees. And I think we were very, in the 2010 legislation, we were really to balance all of the needs of the, of all the, you know, the vested interest groups. And what I meant by saying three of the actives were retirees, they were elected as actives and they fulfill their terms.
Okay.
So, you know, that's another issue that would perhaps have to be addressed if you were thinking that you needed another member on the board. But the official position is we have no position. It's not for or against. It's not neutral. It was explicitly stated as no position.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Thompson, so you're saying that you could have all retired people on the board.
It's sort of only a historical accident, usually. I mean, you'd have to have all four actives being relatively senior and actually intending to probably, and I think all of those probably knew they were going to retire when they ran, but they were prior board members, and we certainly value the retirees' input. I think they are certainly more active than the actives in terms of coming to the board meeting. They have certainly borne a greater sacrifice when we look at the 2010 legislation. And so, you know, I don't dispute the fact that, you know, you're going to have to decide on the merits of the representation yourselves.
Senator Johnson?
Mr. Thompson or whoever, I'm new on the commission. And so what are the vested interests of the retired person on the board or the active person on the board? What are the differences?
I think you, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson. I mean, if you thought that they were only representing their parochial interests, then clearly retirees are looking at the COLA, the actives are looking at the formula, those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, they're all interested in what, you know, the COLA is, because they're all going to be retirees someday. So, and I think within our board, I think there's really a shared interest in from both the actives and the retirees as to what's best. I know, you know, the retirees certainly had a strong interest in what the actives were sacrificing in 2010, and certainly the actives, you know, looked at what the retirees were sacrificing. So I don't look at it as either group representing a specific interest. I think for the teachers, I think there's really been an excellent blended interest, whether you're a retiree or an active.
I can ask Luther.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
If I could ask Mr. Leathers if he would respond to that question.
Mr. Leathers.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I agree with Mr. Thompson in terms of the COLA. That is one thing that Mr. Fisher and Mr. Helly had brought up. I didn't include that tonight. And then the formula for active teachers. I just go back to when I was a teacher. I do about 25 hours a month of pension things, and I do it for active members, and I also do it for people who haven't gotten into the profession yet, because I want a defined benefit pension available to people who are graduating college in 2014, because it means income security in their later years. That's what I would add to that.
Because before the 2010 legislation, it was 2.5.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Thompson, can you provide us with attendance at your meetings? Do you always have every member there?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Thompson.
Generally speaking, they're all there. I mean, it happens that someone may not attend for, you know, various reasons. And I would also say that as far as the general public goes, the retirees are certainly the most representative group that come to our board meetings. There's usually if we have 10 visitors, at least half of them are retirees. So I think that, you know, they certainly have a strong interest. There was a question earlier about the cost, and I would say is that because of the way our elections go, the only cost to us would be the cost of adding a retiree onto the ballot in those, you know, every 2 years, because every 2 years now we have an election for two actives, and every 4 years we add a retiree on there. So in the off year, we would simply be adding a retiree name to the ballot, so there wouldn't be any additional, you know, mailing cost.
Mr. Thompson, the cost question more had to do with mileage and per diem.
Yeah.
Any expenses of an additional board member on your board? I think that's what Representative Murphy was asking. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, so, Mr. Thompson, you're saying that there would be, what would the quorum be if we add another person?
Well, Madam Chair, we'd be going to, 4 and 3 is 8, and we'd be going to 9. So presumably that would be 5, a majority.
It's 5 now.
Five out of the 9 would give you a majority. And
same as 5.
If I look at all the votes of the board, I don't think it's ever been that close on almost any issue.
And with your bylaws, it would still be 5.
Still majority.
Right. I guess I don't recall exactly if it says a majority or if it specifically says, you know, what it specifically says right now. Maybe Mr. Martin recalls.
Okay.
But,
Madam Chair, I asked that question because of I've supported Representative Kahn's intent for years and years to enlarging the size to make the commission 14 people instead of 10 people because of the reasons that then more people would become knowledgeable about pensions, policies, and issues, and have more exchanges of information to share with all our colleagues. And I, that's the main reason. But now that the commission has changed from 10 to 14, we seem to have a harder time getting quorum. And very seldom does it seem like we have all 14 people here at the same time for a long period of time. And that's why I asked the question, in that in our experience here, it hasn't worked so hot. But it doesn't sound like it would be a problem if this bill passes or not, or if we consider the amendments. But
Representative Kahn.
Well, let me, I don't think it has anything to do with the mathematics of that. It has to do with the people who've been appointed who don't show up, which is a problem. But it does show what did happen. You're right. I did work on this for years, and we would always pass it in the House, and then we'd get to the Senate, and we couldn't do it. At one point, we did, to show that compromise sometimes is a very bad thing, we this is when the quorum issue came up, we went to 12 members. And that was really bad because you added two extra members and you increased the quorum by one. Mm-hmm. When we went to 14, you added four extra members.
And increased the quorum by one.
And the quorum was increased by one. So the 14 was much better for quorum getting than the 12 was a problem. But anyway, the...
Well, back to the point.
That doesn't change it.
Mr. Leathers, is there any reason why you don't have a Senate author on this bill? I see XXXX.
Madam Chair, when Mr. Fisher and Mr. Helly went on extended vacations, I worked on one senator, and I talked to Representative Nelson. I thought that it might be a given, but then I called the senator's staff earlier this last week and found out that that wasn't something that the senator was interested in doing. Since then, I've contacted a couple of senators. Like I said, I live 100 miles from St. Paul, so coming up here in a couple times a week is difficult to do, but I've tried to maintain communication with emails and telephone calls and talking to senators and staff, and I will continue to work on that.
Is there any more discussion on this bill? Someone want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 2179 be included in the omnibus pension bill.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. I'm unclear if we have four votes on each side. This is a more of a controversial issue, so.
Madam Chair, could we defer this for another committee so that we could be given more information from, like, I really would like to know what Active Education Minnesota thinks.
Okay.
And maybe talk about the potential amendments.
Okay.
At another meeting.
Representative O'Driscoll.
As a fellow House member, I would concur with Representative Murphy's suggestion of just laying this over, see if we can get a Senate author. I know that we don't need one, but traditionally we have sought authors from both chambers to be able to do these kinds of things. And I know that last time when I had the bill that I had, we only had the House author, and you asked the same question. I knew that Senator Peterson was willing to author that. We also went to other senators in the area and ask them who were affected by this to sign on just so we're following protocol, and I would just ask that we continue to do that. I think that Representative Murphy's suggestion, as well as hearing from Active and Current Education Minnesota, is worth it. We're meeting on a regular basis. It's not that there's going to be any hardship, I think.
It's only
this.
Our second meeting.
And we've got a long time to put this omnibus bill together, relatively speaking.
Okay. At the committee's suggestion, House File 2179 will be laid over. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And reschedule.
And drive carefully back. Yep. At least we have better roads.
Thank you.
And add it to the agenda next
We can add it to a future agenda if there's interest on the part of the commission members. Senate File 2169. And this is Mr. Martin.
Yeah,
Members, I will just give you a brief outline of what the bill does, and then I think the constituent is here, and there may be other individuals who want to testify to flesh out what's being proposed here. This is a service credit purchase, and it's unusual that someone is purchasing their entire career. This is a Hennepin County commissioner who has not been a member of PERA previously and is seeking at age 66 to purchase service credit for his years of service from 1978. The purchase would be at full actuarial value. It would be made from the balance in his defined contribution plan with PERA, his Hennepin County supplemental retirement plan, and state deferred comp if necessary. There's also a provision that if prior to 2018, the interest or mortality assumptions for PERA General would be modified, that the constituent would be obligated to pay the additional amount of any unfunded that would be created because of the assumption change. I think with that, we might want to hear from the constituent and anyone else.
Is Mr. Johnson here? Thank you. Welcome to the commission. Please just introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the commission. My name is Randy Johnson, and I'm a Hennepin County commissioner. Thank you for this opportunity. As Mr. Martin pointed out, this bill would allow me to purchase at full actuarial value service credit from the General Employee Retirement Plan of PERA, and that purchase would be made by a transfer of my account balance in the PERA defined contribution plan. During the 36 years that I have served as a Hennepin County Commissioner, the laws and regs regarding elected officials' participation in PERA have changed from time to time. What this bill would do essentially is allow me to purchase a defined benefit as I could have done until a few years ago. Now, when I was elected to the Hennepin County Board in 1978, no one, least of all me, expected that I would be in office for 11 elections. That puts me in a unique position as a full-time local elected official in Minnesota, and with my years of service far exceeding those of any other elected official in our county's history. As the memo from the executive director notes, the general plan has features such as automatic adjustments and available annuity option forms that are better structured to meet the needs of my wife and me and are not generally available elsewhere. Also understand that there is anticipation of some possible changes in interest rate calculations before 2017 or in mortality actuarial assumptions. The bill provides that any additional cost of such changes would be taken from my defined contribution balance or my balances in MSRS. I want to point out that the bill provides and requires payment of full actuarial value. I ask for your support. Over the years, I've learned a lot about a lot of public policy issues, but I'm certainly not a pension expert, but I'll try to answer any questions.
Did you raise your hand? Representative Kahn.
I'd just like to point out that I am the House author of the bill. And I'm here, and I support this along with my position over the years of always supporting something that doesn't open a cascade. We've written this in a fairly, very limited manner, and where the full actuarial value is being paid. And as Commissioner Johnson said, he's going beyond paying the full actuarial value. If there are changes, he's also willing to pay the increased value of those changes. So I would hope that we
I'm just curious what that full actuarial value is. Do you know, Mr. Johnson?
Mary Vanek probably knows the exact amount.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, first, to respond to your question, the full actuarial value for a single life annuity is $602,223. We assumed if he selected his wife for 100% joint and survivor annuity, while in principle,
joint and survivor annuities are supposed to be an actuarial equivalent to a single life. The fund subsidizes the bounce back provision, where if the joint annuitant dies first, the member gets to go back to the full value of the single life. That calculation came up to $615,219, so it's a little additional cost for a joint and survivor option because of that subsidy. I would just like to comment, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, the commissioner has invested well, and he has more than enough money in his defined contribution plan.
Uh-huh.
But he had many opportunities to enroll in our general plan. We didn't close the door on local government elected officials on a governing board until 2002, elections after June 30th of 2002. But that being said, this bill was just introduced recently. Our Board of Trustees has not met since it was introduced. They meet next week. And I really do need to ask their direction on this bill one way or another.
Okay, well, I think that we have time, that we should respect Ms. Vanek's wishes, and we can discuss it for a few more minutes, and then we'll just lay it over and bring it back. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm just curious with those dollar sums and the various annuity products that are out there this day and age, and you can structure them for different ways of income, why that wouldn't be an option that the testifier would be looking at. Again, there's just a plethora of different opportunities and options out there in the private market that you would be able to have this with a joint and survivor and not even have to annuitize, or you could take sums out and you can manage the income, and there's just so many different things that you can end up doing out there. I'm just intrigued that why is this the best option for you?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. The features of the defined benefit plan are expensive to duplicate on very small scales for small numbers of policies, and very frankly, PRA is extraordinarily well run. They have a very, I'm probably getting the technical term wrong because I'm not a pension expert, but they're very efficient and have low costs of doing business.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, will you refresh my mind? Is this the first time that you've come before this commission?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Murphy, you've got a very good memory. I was here about 5 or 6 years ago, and I believe the commission passed the bill, if I remember right, but we had some further discussions with PERA about the exact calculations for the payments and estimates in the future. I was not looking at retiring imminently, not that I'm looking at retiring imminently now, and I made the decision that it's better to pull the bill and be able to work on the figures further.
So,
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Madam Chair, Commissioner, then your money is in, let me refresh my mind. Your money is in defined contribution now.
That's right.
And your money was in defined contribution before 2002.
Yes.
And you still are a commissioner.
Yes,
I am.
And
are going to continue to be a commissioner.
Well, at some point, either the voters or myself are going to make the decision that I won't be a commissioner.
Right. But your plan is you're continuing on with your work till you don't have a definite date.
That's right.
Okay. And it costs $615,219 approximately. That's what's predicted for you and your wife.
Yes.
And for the second time, then...
She has a pension.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, for the second time, you are coming before the commission then to ask to be considered to buy back into as if you were had been defined benefit all along?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that is correct.
Has your wife, Madam Chair, Commissioner, has your wife worked, and does she have a pension too?
Mr. Commissioner Johnson.
Or isn't that any of my business?
It's in the notes.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's in the notes, also public knowledge. My wife was a public school teacher for 35 years and was an active member of TRA.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Nelson, and then let's try to wrap up.
Just a question I have. We were given two sums, one for if you took single life, and the other one was, if I remember right, Ms. Vanek was for if you took 100% for life for his wife. I guess the question I have for the commissioner is what is his intentions and what is he planning on? Which plan is he picking? Choosing to pick?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I would pick the plan that included the survivor benefit.
100% for life?
Yes.
Any more questions from the commission? Okay, then we're going to lay this over for future consideration after we hear back from Ms. Vanek and her board. And I guess we'll keep the meeting time at 5:30. It seemed to work out well to have Representative Murphy chair the committee if I have to go somewhere. Like I did tonight.
Like I have no life?
No. Representative Murphy already told me that she's thrilled that she doesn't have to go to all these receptions.
Deluded days.
Not supposed to say that. So we'll see you all next week, and the commission is adjourned.
How are you? I haven't talked to you personally.
So two weeks, because I have a board meeting.